Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 2, delivered on January 14, 2016. The title of this lecture is Terminology and Concepts.
Today, terminology and concepts. Start out something pretty darn complicated. What's this? Yes, good. You're good. He's good. Okay. Natural born finance major. Okay, now. In finance, we actually restrict the term money to not everything that has value. Of course, we use the term assets and have value, but it all boils down to money. But money in our technical words refers to short term, less than a year. So I would, if I needed to borrow money for 90 days, I would tap the money market. If I had money to lend for 6 months, I would offer that in the money market. But if I'm looking to borrow money for more than a year, or I have money to invest for more than a year, then what I would call that is a capital market transaction, or attempt for a transaction. So I would access the capital markets if I wanted to borrow money for 30 years. I would provide funds to the capital market if I wanted to lend money for 20 years, 10 years. Now, in the money market is a very heavy market. There are a lot of companies use money markets. For example, one that you, I might even ask you about this on a pop quiz or maybe even on an exam, is large credit-worthy companies that access money for 90 days. They issue a security called commercial paper. And then there are these investors, they have money to lend for 90 days, and there's a deal made. It's a very rich market, thick market. And these are large credit-worthy corporations that do this. Although, interestingly enough, there have been a couple of cases where commercial paper was issued by some company. Investors said, oh, this is safe stuff for 90 days, yeah, I'll lend. And then the companies went and screwed them. Great example would have been Enron. In its last days, as it was dying, the crooks who were at the top of the company issued commercial paper. Enron was a large credit-worthy corporation. Oh, sure, we'll lend you money for 90 days. And they just took that money, those crooks did, and they moved it offshore to their accounts. So sometimes commercial paper, it's not quite as safe as you might imagine. The safest thing you can invest in, lend money in the money market, is a treasury bill, a T-bill, a government-issued security that pays off in 1 year or less. There are 3, 6, and I think 9 and 12 months. They are the safest of all the safe things. The government will pay you back. The sovereign is not going to go bankrupt, notwithstanding some bizarre conspiracy theories. Look, if the government doesn't have the money to pay you back, it can just raise taxes if it has to. It can borrow money from someone else to pay. Or if nothing else, it'll just attack another country on false premises and take its assets. You know, we're good about that. And I'm not even joking about that. The government will pay its bills one way or the other. So T-bills are the ultimately safe of the money market instruments in which to invest. Now, other examples of money market, and I actually deal with this myself. As I told you, I own a company, a small corporation called Emergent Light Studio, that and you see, most companies, especially, I don't even know if they're all the smaller companies, but a lot of companies don't have smooth revenue from week to week, month to month. Most of your revenue happens in a period of a couple of months. And so that's when you got money, but the rest of the year, you are hurting. So many companies use some kind of cash management plan that they work out with banks. They essentially, they say, all right, we've got our financial projections for the coming year. We're going to need to build our inventory. We're going to need to pay our employees. We're going to need to keep the lights on, et cetera, et cetera. And we will draw down on this line of credit that the bank sets up with us. And then when the sales come back up, that's when we will pay off the line of credit that we've borrowed through the year. Some of the old terms for this, one classic term was floor planning. Furniture companies, boat companies, places where they have to build the inventory up front, and then they would sell it during a certain season of the year. In my business, most of my sales, virtually all of my sales, are in the spring and the summer and the early, later spring, summer, and early fall. And the rest of the year, I am hurting for money. So I have to use a cash management account. At the end of the selling season, the exhibitions, the festivals, and all that, I can pay off my bills, but then I'm ready to have to build inventory up through to the next year. Now, that situation is a little bit unusual. A lot of companies, their selling season, their big selling season is the... Their selling season is the, what was I going to tell you? Christmas season, of course. And hence you hear this, all this bitching, well, they're making Christmas start so early. They've got Christmas stuff up in September. You know, can't they keep Christmas sacred? Well, you see, the reality of it is when people say that to me, you got to explain it diplomatically. I just say, look, bitch, I have to sell stuff. And the sooner I start selling it, the sooner I'm going to be able to start paying off this massive line of credit that I've got. And it's just the reality of business is that, yeah, we're going to try to extend our selling season if we can. Realistically, though, yeah, we don't sell it. You can't extend it that much, but you try. But that's another place where you would have a money market. A company that needs money, what we call an economic deficit agent, and someone who has money, an economic surplus agent, and the two of them can be matched up in such a way banks are willing to do this. Now, interestingly enough, just a little historical sidelight, and I'll talk more about this as the semester goes along. There was this insane near apocalypse of the financial markets in the fall of 2000, on September 15th of 2008. Unbeknownst to most people knew that there was something happened and there was a recession, the worst recession since the Great Depression followed it. But most folks don't know that on September the 15th of 2008, the world's financial system almost came to a catastrophic collapse. And of course, well, for one of those few times when our legislature actually pulls its head out of its butt and realizes something is severely wrong, everything got into gear to try to fix the situation. One thing that was definitely done was that banks had tons of liquidity provided to them by the Federal Reserve. Just, you know, get money back into the economy, lend it, whatever you have to do, get the economy going. Don't let it slide into a dark recession after this near apocalypse happened. Well, interestingly enough, these banks got all this money, low interest, no interest loans, money that wasn't even ever paid back and all that kind of stuff, and they didn't lend it. They kept bawling and bleating about a credit crisis. Well, there's a credit crisis. We can't really lend that money we've borrowed or gotten from the Federal Reserve. Matter of fact, a huge amount of that money was in a secret program that wasn't even on the books of the banks. It was blown, the cover on it was blown open in 2010. But the banks just simply let these companies, you know, you floor plan. That's what you've been doing for generations in a furniture store or something like that. And the banks, oh, no, we're not going to floor plan you this year. We're not going to front the money so you can put out the nice furniture. Oh, no, we're not going to floor plan you this year, car dealership, for the cars that you put on the lot for when the people buy them in the spring and the summer and all that kind. No, we're not going to do that. You know, there's a credit crisis. And, of course, that was what one of the driving, the major factors that caused the recession to be so deep and so long was the banks just weren't doing these floor plans. And that's the heart and soul of a lot of business. And I'm going to talk a little more about that in this lecture, too. The small business, the one that lives and breathes from paycheck month to month, payroll to payroll, and all that kind of stuff year to year. But anyway, okay. Now, the money market, that's one market. Now, the capital market is another market entirely. The capital market is long-term. There are those who need capital for capital projects, long-term projects, and there are those who want, who have capital to provide for a long time. Now, there are two broad ways that capital can be made available: debt and equity. Debt is borrowing and lending. Equity is stock ownership, or some kind of ownership. Common stock is the classic way that equity is represented. Debt. Here's where I begin to really start trying to separate you from the common mind and sharpen you. It is one of the places. When you are the borrower, we say that you are the issuer of the debt instrument. When you are the borrower, you are issuing a security. The lender is the buyer of that security. The price is what they're lending you. Now, that sounds a little weird. Okay, well, a company wants to borrow $50 million. It issues a debt instrument. Now, there are these lenders, large funds, trusts, individuals, families, what have you, brokerage house, investment bankers, banking houses, that will do the loan. What they're doing is they are buying that debt security. And the purchase of it is the loan for the price that is on the debt security. Now, that seems a little odd, but that's how it works. Now, let me distinguish here. Any debt security that is less than a year is called a bill. Any debt security that is less than a year is called a bill. Any debt security from 1 to 7 years is called a note. And any debt security that is more than 7 years, actually some books say 10, one way or the other, is called a bond. So now, you, sir, want to buy that dream car of yours. One of those things like, have you ever seen, what is it, that one called the Soul or the Miev? Or don't they recall for ugly anymore? Anyway, so you're going to get, you want to borrow money for 5 years. Okay, and the bank's all on it. Okay, we got it all arranged. Okay, so now what transactionally has happened? Are you the issuer or the buyer of the debt security?
Issuer.
You are the issuer. And you're saying, well, wait a minute, I didn't write up paperwork. No, the bank did, just to make sure. But it's in your name. You're going to sign it first and say, I did this. And then they'll say, sign it, and I agree by buying. Okay, now the purchase price. You're the issuer. Who is the buyer? The bank. Okay, now, what's the purchase price? What are they buying it for? What's the price they're buying it for?
$50,000.
No, the price of the car. You're not getting a $50,000 damn car. Dream on. You wear a red tie with gray stripes. Okay, No, it's going to be the whatever they lend you for the car. That's the price. Now, there might be minus some fees and things like that, points, whatever. But, okay, you follow the idea there? You issued the security. Even though you said, well, I didn't write a debt thing. Well, yeah, you did. They just were helpful enough to write it for on your behalf to make sure that it was exactly the way they wanted in order for them to be able to purchase this debt security. You finally are going to buy that dream house of yours. That's right, that double wide trailer in Decatur. No! Double wide trailer, double wide wife. You've got a job as an assistant manager at the Jiffy Lube on the south side of Decatur. You do Elvis impersonations on the weekends for birthday parties, children's birthday parties. Life is good. And you decide it's time to buy that trailer on a 20-year loan, a mortgage loan. Now, mortgage, all that means on a debt instrument is that there is an attachment that puts an asset in security. That's all mortgage means, okay? It's just a security. Now, who's issuing the security? You're selling a security. Who's going to buy the security? Or whatever lending institution you go to. And what's the purchase price of the security?
Whatever for the house.
Right, whatever they're going to lend you for the house. You might make a down payment of $10,000 and they're going to cover the other $80,000, so total of $90,000. So the price they would pay is the $80,000. Okay, and then you're on the hook to pay them back for that. Okay, you got the idea? Excellent. Okay, now, here's the other side of it. Equity. Equity is ownership. In corporations, the classic example of equity, the representative sign, the security, is called common stock. If I want to raise money as a company, I can sell common stock. You have to go through lots of hoops with regulators and all that, and we'll talk about that much later in the course. But you have to go through hoops, but you can sell common stock. What you're doing is selling ownership pieces to investors. And the investors buy the stock. They become part owners of the corporation. That's what common stock is. Understand this. And just a little later in this lecture, I'll talk about this part. But debt is temporary. Okay? Equity is perpetual. Once you have, when you borrow money, you'll pay it back, and then you got those lenders out of your hair. The security, the debt security is torn up, it's gone. But common stock lives forever. So you, when you sell common stock, you marry the investors. There's another thing too. Investors in common stock, your owners, get something only after all of the debts have been paid in a timely manner. Now that doesn't mean you pay off everything, but you have to pay according to all agreements. You cannot give anything to the owners. The owners get nothing until and unless the debts have been satisfied in a timely manner. In other words, debt holders have the prior claim, shareholders have the residual claim on cash flow. And here's how much worse it is. You see, if you don't give your shareholders anything, all they can do is bitch at you. Cry, whine, come to the annual meeting, put up angry things on Facebook, but they can't do anything to you, especially if they're minority shareholders. They have a minority interest. The debt holders, if you don't pay your bills on time, the money on your notes, the money on your bonds that's due, they will shut you down immediately. They will simply close your doors because they have the prior claim. For God's sake, write this down. The debt holders have the prior claim on cash flow. The shareholders have the residual claim. I tell it like this. Those shareholders can do pretty much, sometimes they'll go to court and some court will pat them on the butt. Oh, you poor share. But for the most part, there's nothing they can do. The debt holders, if you don't pay them when they are due, they will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mama wear furry costumes that please them. Mrs. Fox is a great starter outfit. Never mind. Anyway. Mind you, okay? If I've borrowed $20 million for 20 years from some investor, does that mean I have to pay off all $20 million of the money before I can give my shareholders anything? No. Because I have to only pay them only what is due to them in the current period. That's what I meant by that timely manner. That's why I wanted to ask you that, because I don't want to leave that impression that you have to pay them all off all at once. No, there is a structure. Any security, like a debt security, will have a structure. You pay this much this month, or this much this year. As long as you're doing that along the way, you're good. And you can, if there's money left over, residual cash flow, then that is for the shareholders, okay? Now understand, there are two ways that shareholders can make their claim. You can give the shareholders dividends. Now remember, this is after you've taken care of your debts in a timely manner. You can give your shareholders dividends, or you can take that profit and plow it back into the corporation. You see, if you give them dividends right now, they'll be happy. I've got a check. But if you put the money back into the corporation, the company can grow. It doesn't have to borrow money for capital. If you plow back money that is at the bottom line, that's for the shareholders' benefit. You see, that's the thing is, the directors and the officers of the corporation have to make the decisions on behalf of the shareholders, which is best. To give dividends or to plow the money back. And believe me, this was one of the worst, hardest jobs when I was a consultant. I helped companies go, little companies go public, and little companies how to help them stay public and stay clean. God knows that didn't work out so well sometimes. But the thing was that, I mean, in those early years of companies, there was this one, the shareholders meeting, annual shareholders meeting. You had these people there just bitching up a storm. Where are our dividends? We invested in this stock and we ain't getting no dividend. What are you doing with that money? And I mean, just going on and on. And okay, fine. We will not put any money back into the company. That'll make you happy, won't it? You'll have your damn check and there will be no money so that we can grow this company. What's happened to the price of your stock? Oh, it's gone up a little bit? Well, guess why that was? It wasn't because of you. It was because we took money that could have been a dividend and instead we put that back into the company into a capital project. God, it was just like trying to explain that to them. Here's an interesting sidelight to it, though, is that the real question sometimes, this is an academic question, but it still haunts even when we talk with executives, well, why do you give dividends? If the whole purpose of a corporation is to grow and survive and live, why are you throwing money away, giving it back to the shareholders when you could put it back into the company to secure the company's future and hopefully make the stock price go up? They should be happy because they'll get capital gains. That's what it means when a stock price goes up. That's capital gains. So why do you, the question, it is an academic question because we know darn well companies give dividends all the time. Why are they giving dividends if that's just sort of like throwing the money away? Our best guess, it's actually honestly kind of a guess, it's kind of based upon something called signaling theory. Signaling theory, it's sort of like this. You actually have a very rich uncle. Now every year he comes to visit and he just walks by and hands you a couple $100 bills. Now, he doesn't have to. You're still going to kiss ass to him, even if he doesn't. But what is he doing when he gives you those $100 bills? He's letting you know that he can do it. You see, that's sort of what we suspect is a lot of why companies give dividends. It's a signal that they are so strong that they can just toss money away. Years ago, I was at this corporate Christmas dinner, and the CEO, this was a very well-heeled corporation, CEO gets up there, and he's talking about what an incredible year it was, just going on about how everyone had been involved in making the best year the company had ever had. And there he was, talking like this, and he picks up this glass of wine, and he puts a cigar in his mouth, and then he sets the wine down for a second, and he lights a $100 bill and uses it to light his cigar. That's the first time I'd ever seen that happen in my life. And then he just tosses the $100 bill into an ashtray, and I'm like, he did that because he could, just to show just how much macho he had, how much money that company had, that it could burn a $100 bill on a probably about a $100 cigar he lit while he drank about a $100 glass of wine. Signaling theory. That's kind of what we suspect is going on, at least to some extent with dividends, is that companies don't have to give the dividend. It would be better if they put it back in money into the company and operations, what we call plowback, but you know, they want to show that they are able to send some checks out to their shareholders for their loyalty and all that kind of stuff. I don't know, maybe. Okay. I've swung you around this. Now let me take you back to money for a minute. Let me take you back to money. I want to make sure that you understand. What's money?
Some sort of currency.
Currency. You're looking at me like, oh God, he's going to ask me something. Okay. You make some of the best damn apple pie I have ever had in my life. I mean, you are an apple pie animal. And you make apple pies, lots of them. Okay? So, now I am a moose hunter. Now I get a moose and I'll go around and I come up to you. First, I've gone to you with one moose. I have moose, what you have. And you make very attractive dried flower arrangements. And, of course, I will trade a moose. Now, I've gone with another moose to you, sir. And you make some of the best scarves I have ever seen with the little sequins on them. I mean, they look so good. I mean, I can blind a moose with the bling. Makes it easier. And I traded a moose. Now I'm going over to you, and I've got a moose, and I'm going to trade you 5 apple pies. And you are very happy here. Moose. Woo! No, seriously. I mean, the moose isn't quite dead. It's going, whoa. I don't know. Is that what a moose, though? Okay, but the apple pies. And I go off. Okay. That moose is money. Do you know why?
You get apple pies out of it?
Well, I got scarves. I got dried flower arrangements and that potpourri. That is kicking. I mean, and the apple pie. The apple pie. Shut up. The apple pies. It's money because it was generally accepted in exchange for other assets. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for other assets. You, sir, you sell your body for love. Mm-hmm. No, seriously, I mean, you will become money. You are money. I know, right? It's not for the money. It's for the ladies. No, what I'm saying, though, is that money, we think of money, we are so hidebound, this stuff in our pocket, that's actually only one kind of money. And it's a transitional kind of money. It's been around for some time, but it's not the biggest. Now, the kind of money I'm talking about here, moose money, or anything like that, where the money itself has extensive intrinsic value. You see, you could have a moose and you could trade it for something, or you could eat the moose. The moose meat, it's not the greatest, but it's there, and use the moose antlers, make a really kicky hat and all that, put that on Instagram. You will get likes. And really creepy followers. But the point, though, is that you can use the moose. It has all of its intrinsic value. You can trade it, or you can use it completely, down to the fur. I mean, there's nothing left of that moose after you're done with it. I mean, everything. Even the hooves for wind chimes. I don't know how to talk to you. You never listen to me. Okay. That's called barter money. Barter money. It is the oldest of all monies, and it still exists to this day. Barter money is actually, by some estimates, barter money is in some countries far more common than the kind of money you think of. Historically, barter monies have been the only kind of money that most people had. People think that all through history, in the Egyptian civilization, the Greek civilization, the Roman civilization, all those kinds of things, even in our own civilization in the Middle Ages, everyone had some coins in their pocket. No! Coinage was actually very uncommon. That was something that was held only by the nobles, and then to some extent more extensively by the middle class, the artisans. But most people, their whole lives were spent in transactions in barter monies. Barter monies. The next kind of money is monies that have some intrinsic value, but not as extensively as barters. Those are called metal monies. The classic one is gold. Gold has value intrinsically. You can use it for things. Actually, gold is not, it's very pretty, but it's not great as, for example, as a weapon. I mean, silver, I mean, all. Is another one, nickel, copper, platinum, other ones, alloys. Metal monies carry some intrinsic value, but not all of it. As a matter of fact, we've seen in history, there are great examples. We found spearheads that were actually, we see inscriptions on them. Well, why is there an inscription on a spear point? Oh, it was a coin. Someone hammered it into something that was usable for some reason, for some purpose. So metal monies, they still carry some value, but not complete value. But remember what I said about money before I say anything else. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange. There is no money that is precious in God's eyes. They are all by agreement. These people who say gold should back every currency because gold is something. No, it's nothing more than an agreed upon thing. It's no more special than a dollar bill. Now we go to the last of them. Fiat money. F-I-A-T. I used to call it fiat, but I keep getting corrected. I think it is actually fiat. But F-I-A-T, fiat money. Fiat money is money by decree of the sovereign. It has no intrinsic value whatsoever. Well, maybe a tiny, tiny little bit, but woman, can you read this to me right here? That top thing right there.
Here?
Yes.
This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. In other words, the sovereign says, you accept this or we kick your ass. That's the only reason I accept it. Otherwise, I don't know where this thing has been. It's been in someone's ass pocket. You don't use that one? I mean, I use those. Well, I know. I like to put it on my side pocket because it makes my pelvis look wider. But I'll get you guys loosened up here one of these days. It has no value in and of itself. It's just, you will use this. Now, there is a fourth kind of money. And I will just mention it briefly. And I'll quickly move along. It's a very new kind of money. Have any of you ever heard of cryptocurrencies? Do you know what a cryptocurrency is? Have you ever heard of Bitcoin? Yeah, Bitcoin is one of a number of cryptocurrencies. They don't exist except in the web. Most of them, the transactions are deep web transactions. Cryptocurrencies, the classic is Bitcoin. For my students in the finance club, the Illinois State Students in Finance, I brought in a couple of my friends who are cryptocurrency hashers. Hashers are people who run algorithms day and night to find the encryption for coins, and they capture the coin. I've done it before, but I don't do that anymore, and I'll take them over to a hasher's den here. There's actually a den here, a hasher's den here in town. I'll take them to this coming semester sometime. But the cryptocurrencies are out there. They transact. They're not hugely significant. They're highly volatile right now. And you have to be dedicated to working to capture the coins. But if you're willing to do it, that world is out there. A new kind of currency. The sovereign has ordered us to, has declared, we are going to regulate it. And everyone, yeah, okay, fine. It has no intrinsic value whatsoever. This piece of paper, you could use it for toilet paper or light a cigar with it. I mean, cryptocurrency is zero on the intrinsic value. It is as pure as you get. But I won't go into that in any more detail because I'm supposed to be preparing you for the 20th century jobs. Anyway, so there you go. Barter, commodity, and fiat money. And on the fringe, the cryptocurrencies. For God's sake, if I ask that on a written exam, do not put cryptocurrency. Just say the three classics. Or I'll have to deny I ever told you about them. What else is there? Okay. Now, let me get... now that I've covered what money is, I need to cover one other term. You, sir, are an asset. Okay? I own you. I bought you on eBay. No, seriously. I wrote this song. I put my heart on eBay and you didn't bid. No one would pick it up on a label. I know. Go figure. Okay. But the thing, though, is, can I turn you into a cheeseburger and fries at Culver's? No, I can't. You're an asset, but I can't do that with you. Here's an asset, these dollar bills. Can I turn those into a cheeseburger and fries at Culver's? Yes, I can. Never mind the buy, I am converting. Buying is such a dirty term. We are converting an asset. My goodness. We may live among savages, but we can be civilized. You see, some assets are easy to convert into other assets. Some assets, you are actually worth a great deal of money. I mean, over your lifetime, you're going to produce, the present value of you is probably $6 million. Okay, probably about $2 million in your case. About $6 million, maybe. Maybe more than that. Who knows? Maybe you'll be the CEO of Skynet. You look like the kind who'd do that to your fellow man. Okay. See, I understand what I'm saying, though, is that there are some assets that are easily converted into other assets. And there's no transactions cost, no opportunity cost waiting to have it happen. And then there are, so liquidity is how easy and efficient it is to convert one asset into another. Liquidity is how easy and efficient it is to turn one asset into another. Now, oftentimes we key on turning it into cash. We say this is a highly liquid asset. That means we could turn it into cash very quickly. So a T-bill is an extremely liquid asset because you can turn it into cash within seconds. A house is a highly illiquid asset because we can't turn it into cash very quickly. You know those certificates of deposits that you can get at banks? They are illiquid because it would cost, you could get your money out quickly, but it would cost you. It's not efficient to do that. So CDs would be illiquid to a certain extent. Big assets are illiquid. Cars are illiquid. Houses are illiquid. Other things are not quite so illiquid. Consumables generally are not illiquid. I was actually thinking about this when I was before this lecture. It suddenly hit me. My inventory. Now, we think of inventory as being in the liquid. You know, on a balance sheet, you see the current assets. What they're really saying is these are liquid assets. Okay? In other words, these are assets could be turned into cash within a year, maybe. Accounts receivable. Your marketable securities. Your cash, of course, is already cash. Your inventory. Those are liquid. And then I thought to myself, are my assets actually liquid or not? I have a large inventory of framed, matted photographic art. And it kind of hit me. A lot of these probably would be in my inventory for 5 years before they would be sold. Some of them will sell very rapidly, but some of them will just sit there for a long time. And so you have some companies, they list inventory, but in some ways you have to think about yourselves, if you're really thinking about finance and you're doing analysis, is all of that inventory, which is in the liquid part of the balance sheet, really all that liquid? Or is some of it actually the kind of stuff they've built it, but they probably won't move it for quite some time? Hard to call on that. I have to think about that for my own business a little more, see what the actual liquidity scale on my inventory is. Anyway, let me get on back to something that I had mentioned before. Now I've got to hit it head on. Business is what we do. Economics is actually not a business subject. Economics is about households and businesses. It's about economic agents, the people in the people and organizations in their productive lives. Finance is focused on business. If finance is a branch of economics that is more focused in the business world. Now, let me try this. I've got people in my class who have already had me for a class, so I'll have to find someone who's never had me for it. Madam, what is business? Yeah. That's actually not too bad. Not too bad. I mean, it's funny though because you're all business majors, and yet pinning us down to say what is business is kind of a difficult thing to do. The best way to describe it is business is any organized productive activity. Any organized productive activity. That produces a product to provide to others. Any organized activity that produces a product to provide to others. So you could have a very simple business. You, sir, have you ever made money doing something? Mowing lawns. Have you ever mowed lawns? Like that? Well, you were actually a business. You were a very special kind of business called a sole proprietorship. A sole proprietorship. A sole proprietorship is a one-person operation. And that one person is all at risk. You get to keep the money you make after expenses, but if there is something that happens that is more than you have, your company has, you are entirely at risk. You're mowing a lawn for a rich person in a rich part of town, and you mow over the lady's little poodle. Hey, hi, hi, hi. Give that dog a show dog trim. Well, she is going to take your lawnmower, your truck, and everything in that hovel you call a house, including that shirt, which is actually very tasteful. I compliment you on that. But you won't have it anymore. You won't even have your pants. I wish I had said that because I'm visualizing. That's bad. Okay, here. You are all at risk. Everything you have. The company can't protect you. There is no company. You are the company. Now here, almost every state has a way that you can actually give your company a fictitious name. Even if it's not some fancy corporation, you could. States call it a fictitious name. Others call it an assumed name. Now, understand that all business is state. Business is not federal. States are. This is part of states' rights. States allow companies or allow these things to happen. So. Let me give you a great example. Have you ever heard the term DBA, doing business as? That's basically what I'm talking about here. You can actually go to the state and petition to use a fictitious name. Now, here in Illinois, I will tell you, over the time I've been productive in my life, I've created quite a few of these fictitious name companies. They weren't corporations, they were just sole proprietorships, but I used a fictitious name. You go actually in Illinois, you download a form from the county clerk's office, the county clerk of all things. You fill it out. Who are you? What do you want to call this company of yours? Where do you live? All this kind of stuff. Where is it going to do its business? What kind of business is it going to do? It's a fairly short form. Then you take it back down to the county clerk's office with a modest fee. It's not a bad fee at all. And you give it to them. And they stamp and they say, now, you have to take this to a business publication. And they have to publish for, I think it's 3 weeks. I can't remember, it's been some years ago, last time I did one. But the business publication says, John Smith has applied for the fictitious name John Smith Mowing, or whatever you want to call it, wemowyourpoodle.com, whatever, okay? And then, now there are a lot of these business publications all over the state. You see them, have you ever seen those stacks of newspapers that in front of grocery stores or something like that. That's the kind of places. Now, I use the same place every time. I would send him a copy of the certificate that had been stamped by the county clerk's office, send him the fee, and he would publish for 3 weeks that I am claiming a name. And if nothing happened in 3 weeks, he would send me back a notice. No challenge was given during the time of this publication to this name being claimed by this person. I take it back down to the county clerk's office and they give me a big certificate. The name of my fictitious company and everything else, it's all right there. Now, have any of you listened to my first podcast yet? If you have, you're going to hear on there one of my DBAs. It's a fictitious name, Dark Wraith Publishing. All of my podcasts start with Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium. All that. That's a DBA. It's just me under a fictitious name. Now, what's the use of this? Well, for one thing, it makes you look a little bit more respectable. And most banks will allow you to give them the certificate. Well, if I get a check under John Smith Mowing, that's me. And they'll say, oh, okay. And so you can... You know, deposit your checks, they'll understand this, okay? So it's kind of nice to be able to give you a little reputability. And I've done this over the years. probably a dozen. There were the American Pacific Mining Company, Dark Sun Energy, some other things along the way. I can't even remember all of them. One of my DBAs I created here, I ultimately turned into a corporation, which is the highest form of business. But that's a little bit here, a little bit down the line. Now, back to the sole proprietorship. First things first, sole proprietorship. One person, all at risk. You get the money, you pay the money. You're responsible, you individually. A sole proprietorship dies with you. You can't give your mowing company to your son. You die, it dies. That company does. Because it was you. It was you wearing a mask. Okay? The next kind of business... Oh, by the way, here's an interesting thing. I mean, the book's numbers are a little dodgy because I think it's much more than that. But we'll take the book's numbers for good. 70% of all businesses in the United States are sole proprietorships. Less than 20% of all revenue is sole proprietorships. In other words, but what that means is that the vast majority of business activity, not money or anything like that, but business activity is sole proprietorships. One person shows. But it's probably a lot more than that. Because technically speaking, you sell crack cocaine when you're not in school. Well, you should laugh. You're selling meth. Now, are you going to report your income to the IRS? If I'm calling from Bloomberg, we're collecting statistics on revenue of sole proprietorships. Are you going to tell them that, my meth operation is doing damn well this year? I mean, after Breaking Bad, everyone's tweaking. You see, there's a lot of black and gray market. It's sole proprietorship. That's real business. But it's underground. So realistically, there is probably a lot more. In fact, one of the shocking things, there have been some research papers written, field studies that show this whole thing with fantasy football, fantasy gambling, all that kind of stuff. That is staggering. I mean, staggering. How much money? I mean, even this one group that published a paper, they'd gone underground working in a corporation to track how much money was involved. Even they couldn't believe you were talking in one company, in one skyscraper in New York, hundreds of millions of dollars over a year's period. That's a lot. Sole proprietorship. So really, there's a lot of business activity, legit and illegit, going on as one person shows. Well, now, the next one along the line is where you have more than one person. That's a partnership. Now, a partnership is a little more formal because you have to notify the state. You have to file a partnership agreement to make it legal. But it's more than one person. But know this, the partners are jointly and severally all at risk. So if you and I are partners and I screw up, you wear the whole shebang on you. I do too. But I was last seen leaving town in a late model Huff and I left you holding the bag. It's all your bag. A partnership is just like a sole proprietorship to the extent that the partners are jointly and severally all at risk. All at risk. That's why in the partnerships like law firms, brokerage firms, dental firms, the partnership takes, you have to work your ass off to be taken in as a partner. Did any of you ever see the movie Pursuit of Happiness, that Will Smith movie? Yeah, he was bucking for a partnership. They were going to abuse and make miserable the lives of a bunch of people, and only one of them were they going to take as the one that they would bring in as a junior partner. That's just the way it is. Because once you're in, You are one of them, and if you screw up, they have all screwed up. That's why partnership, if you ever get into one, don't just do it because you like that person. Don't just do it because you think that person is really good at whatever he or she does. Because whatever he or she does, you might not know that some of what he or she does is real screw-up material and you are going to wear it. Know this. Just like a sole proprietorship, when any partner dies, the partnership is over. Gone. It lives with Jesus. It's over. Well, I'll just do a will. I'll give my partnership to my son. No, you don't. Now, if the partnership is set up right at the beginning, the partnership essentially just almost no one could see it. It just folds itself over into a new structure without that partner. Whenever a new partner is brought in, it folds itself over into the partnership again. But technically speaking, it is over when one of the partners dies. And again, remember, the partners are all at risk. Their liability is unlimited personally. There is an exception to this rule. There's an exception to this rule. It's called a limited partnership. And I was involved in those back in the day. All kinds of different ones. It's a fascinating world. Here's how a limited partnership works. There are the general partners. They're the ones all at risk, the show. But then you can bring in limited partners. They pay money to become part of this business, but they are not allowed to touch the operations themselves. They have to sit on their asses on the sidelines and hope that things go right with their money. Their liability is limited to their investment. They can't be sued an infinite amount like the general partners can. These are so common, and there are so many varieties of them. Back in my time, one that I got involved in were these things called low-income housing for the elderly partnerships. Here's how they worked. The federal government had a plant program. And this was probably from the 70s, but I saw it in the 80s and the early 90s. Excuse me. Where the federal government would say, okay, we need housing that is nice for old people. So what we're going to do is, if a company will commit money of its own in a sufficient amount, we will provide matching funds as low interest, no interest loans, grants, what have you, to build these nice apartment complexes where we will then subsidize the rent of the people who live there. So in other words, if we will commit blood, and now they use the term commit skin, but I still use the old term, we commit blood of $10 million, we can have the government provide through low interest, no interest loans, grants, another $10 million. States got involved in this too because they wanted this kind of housing. Great. So what we would do is our little general partner group would start up, say, all right, we need investors, $50,000 a unit, $100,000 a unit, whatever you want to call it. And what we'll do is you invest, and then you will, as this thing we're doing makes money, you will be paid your share of the profit that we generate. Okay, great thing going on. Pull together $10 million. So you've got a total of 20, you build a really nice apartment complex. It's not a Hyatt or something like that, but it's a decent place for old people to live, for God's sake, so they don't have to live miserably after they've done their best their whole lives. So, okay, great. So at the end of the year, well, we send our limited partners, okay, here's your share of the money. Oh, we didn't send them any checks. We sent them two documents. Okay, one document would report their profit, their share of the profit. Well, sorry about your luck. Your $100,000 investment this year, your share of the profit is negative $18,000. Sorry. And then we sent them another document. Okay, here's your share of asset appreciation. Well, these things depreciate like a son of a dog, especially when we accelerate the depreciation. You lost another, $15,000 in asset depreciation. Wow. And then, of course, within a few weeks, they'd be calling us up, these investors, rich doctors, rich lawyers, rich architects, rich this, rich that. When can we get into our next one with you? We love what you're doing. Another year, we send them even worse losses. Another year, we send them more loss asset depreciation. They're coming back. When are you going to do your next one so we can get involved, please? Okay, are they off the rockers? Oh, absolutely not. You got a doctor who's got $500,000 in taxable income. For his investment in our company, he gets to take away maybe a total of about $30,000 of taxable income off that. Year over year over year. He is avoiding, let's say he's in a 40% marginal tax bracket. We've just had him write off $30,000 of his income. Well, there you go, right there, $30,000 at 40%. So he saved himself a nice change. For an investment of $50,000, he's probably going to save sending Uncle Sam a couple hundred thousand over the life of the project. And then we close it down, sell it to some REIT or something like that, and then we go on and do more. That is a classic loss vehicle, limited liability company, rather a limited partnership. Is it legal? Oh, hell yes. The government knew exactly what we were doing. They set it up so that we could lose money out the ass for our investors. We paid ourselves a decent salary. Hey, it was hard sitting there writing orders up and all that kind of stuff and answering phones. But you understand, this was to the purpose of making it so that people, old people, had a nice place to live at a decent rent that the government would subsidize once we built the places. And that's one of the only reasons there are some of these nice places for old people to live now, is because of this game we played. Okay, there are other partnerships that are limited partnerships that are not, definitely not loss vehicles. I mean, oil and gas partnerships, definitely I got into. But there were other places where you might not know about limited partnerships. One place would be in the entertainment industry. One of the first genres of entertainment to use limited partnerships were adult movie producers. They would simply say, all right, we're going to need $1 million for this movie. We're going to have to hire 10 talent, 4 cameras, 2 days in a motel, renting four or five rooms. We're going to need lights. We're going to need all the sheets and all that kind of stuff. We're going to need backgrounds, backdrops and all that. Someone to write a quick script. Okay, we get it done. What we're going to do is we're going to go to a bunch of old creepy guys and we're going to say, all right, you're rich, you're filthy rich. We want to jump in and put $100,000 into our limited partnership. Oh, yeah, can I watch? No, you're not allowed to get anywhere near it, you pervert. And then what you do is once you've done cut the movie 4 days into the can, then you sell to 15,000 houses, VHS, beta tapes, and then you've got your international markets. By the time it's over, you've got a $20 million revenue in 6 months. Those guys who put in $100,000 each are living fine, and then they're ready for the next one. That was why there was a proliferation of well over 100,000 adult movies in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. It spread from there into other parts of entertainment. Limited partnerships began to show up in music, and movies. A lot of movie people got so sick of the big, heavy moguls of Hollywood and their, well, I want the script this way, and their, I want you to hire this person, and I want this lady to come into my office and talk to me about acting for me. They got sick of it. So what they did was they started setting up limited partnerships to make movies, indie movies. Are oftentimes through limited partnerships. Look, you put together $2 million and you can get yourself a darn good indie movie made through limited partnerships. Set them up. And it's not that hard. Well, it used to be. It's not that hard, though, to be able to pull off enough money, sell enough copies of it. And that's one of the really important things, though, is that when you're going to do indie movies like that, you got to get the movie to Cannes, to Toronto, to all the London, to the festivals, so that it is recognized there, because that's how you get into the art houses with the movie. That's how you generate the revenues. That's how you get the DVDs cut. And that's how you get the money back to the investors so they'll say yes again. This isn't small potato stuff. Don't get me wrong. There are some big, big heavies in Hollywood who are now making their own movies independently, many of them through some structure that's similar to a limited partnership. Some of the movies that you watch, the box office blockbusters are actually in limited partnership arrangements. It's also showing up now. There were some hip hop and rap artists who got very smart about setting up limited liability partnerships to get some of their tricks done, to cut an album, because institutional Hollywood, institutional LA, all that kind of stuff was saying no to their music, no to their innovation, saying the hell with that. And so what they did was they went out, they set up limited partnerships, got themselves enough money to get a stage, sound booth, get some CDs cut and all that kind of stuff, get their name out there, pay for a tour with their album and all that. It's starting to show up more and more. Some garage bands are getting smart and they're beginning to use this method. It's showing up all kinds of places. It's a great thing, but it also produces a lot of crap and you can lose your shirt investing in these. Now, the ultimate is the corporation. The ultimate form of business is a corporation. Because a corporation is a legal entity of its own. The owners are not the corporation. In a sole proprietorship and a partnership, the company is the owners, and the owners are the company. In a corporation, the law, state law, recognizes that company as a legal entity bound by the laws of the state of incorporation and by the laws of the states in which it does business. Now, you can incorporate in any state you want. Some states are more favorable than others. Some states are just downright hostile. A lot of companies historically incorporated in Delaware, the state of Delaware, because it had such a sophisticated, mature business law. It had its own court system for business judges and all that. But there are other states that are fine. Some states you just do not want to ever incorporate. You would be an idiot. Florida is one. South Dakota. Utah used to be a Wild West. It was great. Then it turned into a bunch of asses. Nevada. I can say that now. My statute of limitations is up on those problems I had. They were lies anyway. But know this. The liabilities of the corporation are the corporations, not the owners. But that's why those who oversee the corporation have fiduciary duty. The corporation can't protect itself. It can't pay its own bills. So it has to be shepherded by responsible parties. Here's the upshot of it. I'm going to tell you a secret. I'm going to tell you a really dark secret. You are going to die someday. No. Don't blow me off. It's going to hurt like hell. You're going to bitch and fuss, and then you're going to, finally you'll die and shut up. You see, that means that sole proprietorships and partnerships are mortal. A corporation is immortal. Unless it is killed, a corporation lives forever. It is a person under the law, but it is not a people. Because it, unlike you, it doesn't have to die. You have to die. Sorry to tell you that. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.